Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome back to the Reformed Dissenters. I'm Bruce Johnson, joined by my brother Jacob Johnson.
Hello everybody.
And this is the show you're listening to, the show where Reformed Christians dissent against popular ideas of culture by asserting a biblical worldview. And today we are talking about Adam Terrell's book, Public Stoning, God's Design for a Nation Without Prisons. And we are talking about chapters 9 and 10. Did I get that right, Jake? 9 and 10?
Yes.
Yes, let's just go with that. This is our second to last week with this book. We've got one more week before we wrap it up. And we have an official date. Actually, we do have an official date now where when we're going to have Mr. Terrell on the show. Let me see if I can actually bring this up so that I'm not just making stuff up. Anyways, we'll be posting it on social media, I believe. It is on the 7th. No. Yes, it will go live. Oh my goodness, why did I not pull this up before? This is horrible. It will go live next week or the week after. Oh, no. The 8th. There it is. Only took an eternity, but we got there. May 8th, Mr. Adam Terrell himself will be on the show. So you want to stay tuned for that. Also, I was instructed by our director of Serrated Edge, Aaron Jensen, to inform you all that we will be doing a very special promotional thingy, is the technical term I just learned, for our 300th episode, which is coming up in about 20 episodes or so. I think 20 episodes? No, less than 20. 10, my word, 12 episodes from Wednesday. We're coming up on episode 300, and there will be a very special thing coming. So stay tuned for that. You really don't want to miss out on this. Aaron did some thinking and came up with something really cool. So stay tuned for that. But today we're talking about chapters 9 and 10 in Adam Terrell's book. Before we get into all that, though, we have to do what we always do, which is talk about our verse of the week. And Fridays means that Jacob talks about that. So take it away, Jacob.
Yeah, and our verse this week is Psalm 37, verses 10 through 11. And these verses say, "In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." And Bruce did an amazing job going over this on Wednesday. And kind of going to just break down similar ideas that Bruce was going over, kind of going over the same. Bruce picked out verses 8 through 15 to also discuss and bring up as more of a broader picture of this specific verse. So I will go over that in a second, but I did want to mention this being very, very interesting, because we see this kind of, well, we see this in the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, I think it is, where Christ is kind of mirroring this and saying, blessed is the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, or all of those things. And so this is kind of where that sort of comes from. And I just wanted to kind of bring that up, that Psalms also mentions this. And I also think it's a little funny that without the wicked in the world, the believers will enjoy abundant peace. I thought that was a little interesting that, well, Bruce was mentioning the tongue-in-cheek that David brings up in the Psalms here in talking about the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. Just staring at, like,
where'd he go?
Oh, what's going on? They used to be here. But this sort of thing of where, hey, they're not there. And guess what? It's not going to be peaceful. That the unrighteous are the ones who bring unpeacefulness, even though they say they want to bring peace. But I wanted to read verses 8 through 15. And these verses say, "Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil." I'll just bring up this point as I'm here. This fretting not yourself, Bruce was mentioning on Wednesday, the fact that we shouldn't be afraid of the fact that, hey, they're no longer, the future is good. It's like, it should be hopeful. You shouldn't be worried about the future. It's a hopeful future. Fretting will only lead yourself to evil. Continue verse 9. For the evildoers shall be cut off. And this is the reason why we should be hopeful. For those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. Again, Bruce was mentioning that parallel between verse 11 and verse 9. In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace. The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. The wicked draw the sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose way is upright. Their sword shall enter their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. And that was to the end of verse 15. And I love how this, between verse 12 and verse 13, it mirrors Psalms 2, talking about the wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. And also into verse 13, but the Lord laughs. We think of this, the Lord laughs and holds them in derision, as Psalms 2 says. But this is interesting because it does bring up why the Lord laughs, because the Lord sees that his day is coming. Lord knows that they will be demolished. So he laughs at them, that they're plotting in vain, that they're doing these things all in vain. And the Lord laughs. So.
Yep. Yep. Oh, it's so good. Yeah. Oh, the Psalms. The Bible is immense and full of just incredible wisdom. But the Psalms are just simply astounding. And the more you read them, the more you find. And especially the more you sing them, the more things stand out to you. It's just kind of insane how that works. So moving into Adam Terrell's book, Public Stoning, God's Design for a Nation Without Prisons. We're moving into chapters 9 and 10 today, as we've mentioned. And up until this point, I do want to note, up until this point, I have, you know, the large majority of this book has just been phenomenal. And I still encourage people to grab a copy of this book, consider it, read it, and at least hear what he has to say and discuss. If you believe he's wrong, well, you're going to be, he's done such an extensive job laying out his point that if you disagree with him, you're really going to have to prove why. And I won't be doing that to the extent that I should today, but I do disagree with him in this particular chapter, but I want to emphasize the fact that I don't want my disagreement to take away from the rest of this book, my disagreement with this one chapter to take away from the rest of the book. So, cause it really is a good book. And remember, his stated goal from the onset has always been to encourage conversation, to get Christians thinking about these things, to get Christians loving the law of God again and recognizing how just and true and good and beautiful and glorious and reviving to the soul the law of God is. And it is all those things and more. And he's done a wonderful job pointing that out. In this chapter, though, he builds off of the last chapter, chapter 8, where he set a premise. And the premise was that the church has the duty to execute those that it excommunicates. And he warned me going into this book, hey, because we were going to have him on the show, and he's like, hey, you might want to have me on later after maybe you've read the book, because there will be points of disagreement that you'll want to discuss. And we found it. and I think we'll have a very cordial and great conversation, but I do disagree with him on this point. It's definitely something I need to look into and study. But I do not believe that it is the church's responsibility to execute those that it excommunicates. Now, I think one of the things that that would bring with it, and I think he does make this point, is that excommunication would be thought of much, much higher. It's a very important thing. If someone could actually be executed when they're excommunicated, that would just be a last resort for so many reasons. But it would be something taken with much more seriousness than it is today. So there's that. But apart from that, it's a difficult case to make. Now, he brings in Matthew 18. He brings in, Colossians, Corinthians. I'll get the passage right when I get to it in a second. He brings in several passages, which I read through. And 1 Corinthians 5:11, where in those passages, the point is not necessarily that excommunication and execution for that are disconnected entirely, right? He brings up a valid point that the same language used in the Old Testament, purge the evil from among you, always referred to the death penalty largely, and that's the phrase that's pulled in here. He also addresses, I think, to an extent, the objection that I would raise, which is the restoring of the individual. It's always been my belief that excommunication should be done with the end goal, the result, wanting to be a restoration to the church, restoring that individual into communication with God and his church and his people, right? And obviously, if you execute that person, that's impossible, right? Now, I think he would say, well, spiritually, they could be right with God, but they still have execution coming, to which I would disagree, I think. They didn't commit murder. And I think that it's a difficult case to try and make just because the phrases are similar. He brings the receipts, and I am, of course, watering this down and oversimplifying. But in my oversimplification, I'm not convinced that that is the church's job. And, I've used Romans 13 before to discuss, hey, that civil government's job is to bear the sword. Now, that passage doesn't exclude the church from bearing the sword, right? It doesn't say only the civil government may bear the sword. It just says that the civil government does bear the sword. Doesn't mean that the church doesn't do that either. So you can't just use that to argue, I realize. But I do think that one of the most clear places we see the, death penalty is with the civil government. And it's a much, much harder case to try and make it for the church. Anyways, all that being said, because I disagree with his initial premise, when you get to chapter 9, much of chapter 9 is built around the initial premise, right? And so we get to, quote, on page 119, where he says, quote, "We have had the authority to put our members to death, taken from us by God for his for our rebellion to his law. It is good that it has been stripped away from us by the nations at this time. The church has rejected this responsibility and engaged in all kinds of capital offenses to boot. We've not proven ourselves ready to be trusted with it again yet." He does go on, and this is what I was talking to Jake about in the pre-show. While I do disagree with his premise, I do think his words of encouragement, I would apply them to a different result. But I would argue that I would take all of his encouragement. He kind of builds it in as encouragement for the church. I would build it in as encouragement for the civil government and say, civil government, we as the people, because there's no justice in the land, because blood and death and murder do pollute the land. And we see that very clearly. Terrell's outlined that. God's word makes it very clear that murder not handled justly does pollute the land, and I still believe that that the land will rejoice when murderers are put to death, when the death penalty is reinstituted the way it should be. And so I can say pretty confidently that the encouragement he applies to the church, I would actually apply to the civil government and say, yes, one day in our future, justice will be restored in our land. I do believe that. Whether it's this land or whatever comes up in the ashes of America, if God decides to humble America to that point, right? And the encouragements that he lists in this chapter, I would apply to the civil government. Same with this quote on page 120. Quote, "I shudder to think how much worse of a name Christ would have among unbelievers if we had this authority right now." I would say by we, I would say the civil government. And these words would still apply. "We get it back by seeking the good of the city and serving Nebuchadnezzar, as it were, as unto the Lord without sin. This will show a spirit of repentance. This will include civil disobedience as at times, as with David and the Hebrew midwives, Exodus 1:15-21. But if it is in obedience to God, he will save us from the furnaces and lions' dens, as it were. By doing this, we will have a good name restored to us, and Nebuchadnezzar praised the Jews, as Nebuchadnezzar praised the Jews for setting aside his own decrees in obedience to God." Daniel 3:28-30. So, same language there. I would apply to the civil government and say, yes, that's, you know, right now we are in a nation under judgment. And it is our duty to civilly disobey if we are called to, by the civil government, do what is not lawful. For instance, if we are called to just wear the mask, right? Or just take the jab, right? All those things during COVID that we were told to do. And many of us said, no, we're not going to propagate your lie. No, we're not going to tell our neighbor that this is an acceptable thing and propagate the lie that this actually does something just so that you can feel better. That's not loving. It's not caring. We're not going to do that, right? And so that was an act of civil disobedience, but it was the biblical, I believe, Christian thing to do. And that was an example here, I believe, of what he's talking about. But our nation is still under judgment. And while we do those little, small acts, right, there are, we are working towards a Christianized society in much, much deeper ways, much more lasting ways, building families, building businesses, building a culture under the surface so that when God brings them low, which he will, and he is doing, just look at Disney. If you need an example of a wicked company being brought to its knees, look at their profit margins and tell me they're doing great.
I think,
and we need a culture. Go ahead.
I think added to this is the fact that if you say that the church should bear the sword like this when the civil government can't, I don't think that we understand the fact that, hey, the reason the civil government is unable to bear the sword correctly because the church isn't. Right? Because, okay, now that the church isn't able to bear the sword correctly, but the church has lost God's law, that's why the civil government has fallen. We always say that it starts with the pulpit. It starts with the church. If the church fails, then the civil government fails. It's not, oh, the civil government fails, so now the church has to come back. So now the church has to bring it back. Now, normally, as we've seen throughout culture and history, the church fails, then the government fails.
Right.
So if we're saying that, hey, the church needs to now bear the sword since the civil government can't, I don't think the church can. Because we don't even know God's law the right way.
Yeah.
I would
not
say,
in the state to do that.
Yeah. I would say the majority of churches, if you handed that to them, they would have no idea how to even use it.
Right. Right. Yeah. Which is even, even if it were as we believed, even if we did believe that was the right thing for churches to do.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. There was much more said in this chapter. Check it out. But obviously we're going to have differences of opinion and we'll kind of not go that route with things. But like I said, don't let one chapter overrule the rest of the book, because I do think like huge chunks of the rest of the book was really good, really well done. So with that, I'll pass it over to you, Jake, just to chat about chapter 10. What we got? Yep.
Okay. So this chapter is titled Practical Objections. So it's just raising a couple questions that people might have and then kind of giving an answer for it. He's done this before, I feel, in other chapters, and kind of like brings up a question, a common question that might be brought up against him, and then refutes it. Hold on. Okay, here's the question. I'll read the question and then I'll sort of give his answer for a few of these. On page 125, he says, if there's a truthful single eyewitness of a murder and substantial evidence accompanying evidence, can't courts today do an excellent job of determining the facts of a case with modern DNA evidence and similar techniques? So I thought this was an interesting question because it's like, oh, you know, but we have science today, you know, so we can figure stuff out even with only having one witness to this crime. And I like his stance on this. I like his kind of strictness on this. He continues right after that saying, before public stoning or any other requirement enforced by a court can be practiced lawfully in a city, the people in that city must understand that a judge can't hear a case without two witnesses accusing who would be punished accordingly if found to be lying. So kind of the point of that evidence, the point of the two witnesses is that, hey, also, these are more living people. These are human beings that, hey, if you're lying, if you're presenting false evidence, if you're presenting false testimonies, then, hey, you're going to now suffer the same fate that you want this guy to be accused of. So whereas if you bring evidence, if you just bring DNA evidence, the DNA can't be, you know, charged with the same thing that person is being charged with. He does also mention, and I thought this was interesting, but he does also mention if a scientist comes forward and has DNA proof and all that and wants to appear as that second witness and wants to put his life on the line, then fine. Then that's fine. Then he's that second witness. But now he's putting his life on the line. If it finds out that he's wrong, he's getting punished for that.
Yep.
Continue on page 126. He says, someone could see a murder and call the authorities. Oh, and this is exactly what I was talking about, but here's now the quote to kind of back it up. Someone could see a murder and call the authorities who give a public adjuration for other witnesses to come forward and testify, Leviticus 5:1. And if no one else comes forward, nothing should be done, even though all common sense points directly to the guilty man. So in this one, he's talking about, hey, if there's no second witness, if one person witnesses and reports the crime, but there's no second witness, it's cut. It's done. Okay. And I like that severity, that clear cut, we're done. We can't do this without a second witness.
Yeah.
And I think that's good because especially with how strict we're going to be taking this, in that if you're brought up in murder charges and you're found to be wrong and you're found to be guilty, that's stoning. Specifically, he mentions the gruesomeness of stoning as it is. So if we do want this,
not a light matter.
Right. So it does have to be very strict on how we go through with that. And we have to be certain, absolutely certain, that this person did actually do this crime. So I think that's very good, especially if you think about it, because a lot of people, their objection is like, wow, this is such a gruesome and barbaric. He speaks about that later on, which I do want to mention. Very, very cool the way he says this. But like, if this is, people are, you know, looking at this and being like, wow, stoning, that's gruesome. That's awful, you know. But it you have to have that other part of it that says, well, we can't just do this on a whim. So to continue on, again on page 126, another question is brought up. Won't unbelievers charge us with murder or taking the law into our own hands? Which he says to that, we don't seek to stone outsiders, non-Israelites / non-believers / non-sojourners. That's not within our jurisdiction. I'm assuming he's speaking about the church here, in that it's not within the church's jurisdiction, because I would say from the civil government standpoint, it is within their jurisdiction to punish anybody who commits a crime, no matter whether you're a believer or a non-believer. Continues on, what do we have to do with judging outsiders? God will judge them. 1 Corinthians 5:12-13. We only want to judge ourselves and willing sojourners among us who choose to live by these standards also. So, is this voluntarily agreeing to be stoned? Yes. Shouldn't a murderer admit what he did and face the consequences in honesty? So if believers think this is crazy, why would they stop us? Sorry, so if unbelievers think this is crazy, why would they stop us from enforcing this on ourselves? They'll eradicate themselves and make themselves a stench to repel new people, right? Therefore, the only reasonable reason that unbelievers would try to stop believers from enforcing this on ourselves is because they are afraid that it might actually be beneficial to believers and produce earth-changing results for the better of mankind. By opposing us in this way, in this, they would give this idea credibility. And by supporting us, they help us. Either they discredit themselves or we win. End quote. And in the same way that Bruce was speaking about before, I disagree about the church aspect of this, but also the fact that I still don't see how this is like, okay, we go through with this. First of all, he does mention, so he's just talking about, I think, people on the outside taking offense at this and just not like, okay, because he does also mention later on the fact of, if the civil government sees us doing this, won't there be ramifications for us, in a sense, murdering people? Even though we by God's law, see it as a just punishment, what they're going to see is, hey, these church members are murdering their other fellow church members. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to see it as beneficial, or they're not going to see it as, oh, well, they're just, you know, they're taking care of themselves, I guess, you know. So
yeah,
even if they knew, hey, this person that they just killed was a murderer, did murder people, and they were just punishing him, they wouldn't see it as that. There are literal laws that say people who do that are vigilantes and are wrong.
Yeah.
So,
well, and part of it too is, if we now open the death penalty to excommunication,
yeah,
there are a lot more matters and sins that people are excommunicated for that are not just murder. And so now you're opening the door for excommunication within the church, excommunication, well, and execution of a lot more matters and actual sins, right? Which now sort of demolishes the sins versus crimes debate we have.
Yeah.
And now we're saying, oh, at least it seems to me, I don't want to set up a straw man, but certainly seems like now we're suggesting that sins can be treated at the same level as crimes, incurring the death penalty,
yeah,
if that person is a believer, which I don't know. I really don't think. I think that's a really tough case.
Have we seen in the Bible any person who has been excommunicated also be charged with the death penalty.
Put to death.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't believe so.
Yeah. I have one last quote. I know we're a little over time, but I have one last quote that I want to bring up, and this is the barbaric one. The question is, isn't stoning barbaric? And he answers this by saying, I believe our primary concern should be over whether or not something is right. End quote. I thought that was very well put. Like, it's not about barbarity or non-barbarity. That's not the question.
Right.
The question is this right or is this wrong? We shouldn't, just because it's barbaric doesn't mean it's wrong. I think too much in our society today, we think of old as being bad, new being good.
Yeah.
So, and that's sort of our enlightenment culture. That's sort of our enlightenment age. So, with that said, that is my quote.
Whole chapter. Well, thanks for grabbing those quotes, Jake, for studying through this. We really appreciate, like we've said, we appreciate the rest of this book a lot. There are a lot of really good things in this book, so we still highly encourage people to check it out. It's just these two and a half chapters of a lot of this content, and we were forewarned that this would be controversial. So we are.
That's why,
by far. Go ahead.
And that's why we're having him on. So if anybody has any questions about stuff that we've read, issues that you may have, definitely put in your questions, send your questions, and we would love to ask them of him on our show.
Yep. So. Absolutely. And with that, thank you all so much for watching or listening to us today. Our website is trdshow.net. We have all of our episodes on there for free and censorship free. We're back on YouTube for now, but who knows how long that'll last, because it didn't last too long last time. Also, follow us on all of our social media platforms, Gab, Getter, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all the places. And until then, have a great rest of your weekend. Have a wonderful Lord's Day. And we will see you on Wednesday when we're back once again to talk about current events from a biblical perspective.
And remember, everyone, in all that you do, do it as unto the Lord.